And indeed, in North America, they are maintaining their own identity, that, as Breck pointed out, that, you know, and you asked the question that, you know, many European women convert to Islam, they adopt the hijab, they put on the hijab because they feel more dignified in that. And that is something that terrifies the liberals, because then they cannot manipulate these people. Right. They cannot show the superiority of their value. So that is really what is really scaring them at this time.
Okay. Well, Brett, how can the European court do this? When, if we read the EU Constitution, there are several articles which contradict this ruling. I mean, let's start off with Article 10, which says everyone has freedom of religion. Article 11, which says everyone has the right of freedom of expression. I mean, is it logical for the court representing the EU to contradict the EU Constitution?
Well, here is, of course, what they do is sort of conjuring around with vague terms that can be interpreted in a variety of different ways. For example, this European Court of Justice ruling, of course, said that the banning of the hijab is allowed not only as part of a universally enforced policy of neutrality on the work floor, which is, of course, one of the reasons why, as mentioned, the Sikh member of parliament in the United Kingdom has also very rightfully complained against this this ruling, because it will also affect the Sikhs, of course. It will also affect the Jews. But this is how they sort of how they cover themselves up, and by saying, like, this is not something that directly targets only the Islamic community. Of course, this is what they claim. The second thing what they do is they cover themselves up even more by saying this can only be done if there is a so-called genuine to the corporation, if it causes any conflict with the customers. Again, what does this mean? If a customer that walks in, if one day there is one customer who is a rabid Islamophobe, you have a conflict with a customer. And you could just so technically say that at that point the company would be within its right to suddenly ban a woman who maybe has worked there for years with a hijab, to suddenly demand her to take off her hijab or leave the company because of that one customer. And of course, the thirdly is that the European Court of Justice said that this is all still dependent on the national legislation that exists. And that way, again, the European Union, what they often do is they give these sort of, they push the countries in a certain direction, but when push really comes to shove, they can say, well, that is depending on your national legislation. Of course, this will be massively different between France, which has already pushed a very aggressively anti-Islamic agenda over the years, mm-hmm. and, for example, Austria, in which the court recently destroyed a ban of the hijab in primary school because they said this was discriminatory. So this is the way in which they kind of conjure up these terms and conjure up these lingos and these jargons with which they can always pretend that this is not directly targeted at Muslims. Of course, everyone who knows and who is not, let's say, on the payroll of these European powers and looks at this, knows that we're talking, of course, specifically talking mostly about Muslims, just as when countries want to ban.
Okay, Zafar, let me get Zafar in. I'm so sorry, Brett, just about out of time. But Zafar, where is all this going? I mean, as more and more there's an increasing amount of contradictions between Western liberalism rhetoric and the reality, and there seems to be such pushback against Muslims, especially Muslim women. Where do you see all this going? Are we talking about more divisive societies? And what does it mean for Muslims in Europe?
Well, I think what this is going to do is to make the Muslims realize that even if they want to integrate into European societies on their own terms, of course, that they would not be allowed to do so. So despite the fact that Muslims were beginning to engage politically in the political process, now I think they would be forced to abandon that route, which I think in the long run, it would be beneficial for Muslims, because Muslims will now begin to think outside the box, outside the political framework that exists, because this political framework has actually rejected the Muslims. Muslims will now be forced to think of alternatives, which is that they need to develop their own identity, their own institutions, and their own political processes within these societies to continue to exist. Okay. Short of these Muslims being thrown out of these societies, that's the only course left to them.
Thank you both for being with me on the Spotlight. Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, and President of Islamic Society of the York Region, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers, out of Hasselt. Thank you both for being with us, and thank you, viewers, for joining me on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear brothers and sisters, welcome to Heavenly Grief. I'm your host Zatar. With me today is my brother Sheikh Muhammad. Sheikhna, thank you for coming.
عليكم السلام and thank you for having me.
It's always an honor and a pleasure to have you, Sheikhna. So brothers and sisters, these are the days of remembering the martyrdom of our beloved Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. And one of the aspects of the life of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, which was him starting to revive the school of thought of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhum salam. And why Imam Baqir alayhi salam had the chance to do that, and that is because of the crumble of the Umayyad Khalifa, and it was before the Abbasi Khalifa were enthroned. One of the factors that Imam alayhi salam did during his life, which was emphasizing and recommending for his Shia, for his companions, not only for his Shia and his companions, for all Muslims, for all people, to take narrations and to give narrations and to know the source. Which, and the source, of course, was Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, for there is nothing right unless it came from them, alayhi salam. So, Sheikhna, if you could please continue your beautiful words.
Thank you so very much. The third thing is the emphasis of Imam Baqir sallallahu alayhi wa sallam on writing. For example, Imam Baqir alayhi salam says, "Uktubu hadithakum fasawfa tahtajuna ila kutubakum." This is a movement from Imam Baqir.
So Imam alayhi salam was saying, "Write down the sayings because you will need it in
need
the future."
In the future, this was the start of a movement in Shia and the followers of Imam alayhi salam. What kind of movement? After the attempts and you know, endeavors of Imam Baqir Salawatullah Alayh and his son Imam Sadiq Alayhi Salam, a systematic writing and authorizing organization by the followers of Imam Alayhi Salam was created. And before Imam Baqir Alayhi Salam, you know, writing books by Shias was not a systematic kind of activity. Seldom books, you know, they have been written, for example, Asrar al-Muhammad alayhi salam by Sulaym ibn Qais, for example. Very few books by the companions of Ahlul Bayt because of the time, because of the area, and because of the
rulership as well. Rulership, because there was a rule, yes. it was not allowed to write the sayings.
Not allowing, yes. But in this time, because of the attempts of Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, this encouragement was so widespread among the Shia, and they started to hear hadith and to write hadith, to write books of hadith. And this helped so much. The Shia, the life of Shia in that time and in the other times, and right now, whatever we have in terms of understanding of Islamic thought is because of their attempts, because of what they have done, because of the books that we have received in our Islamic knowledge. So the third thing, the encouragement to write the books. The next thing that was very important for Imam Baqir Salawatullah Alayh was the fact of not implementing your own thoughts and your own understanding and prejudices and not attributing them to God. For example, you know, the students of Imam Baqir were raised this way. They were educated this way. For example, Abu Hanifa and Muhammad and Muslim. These are two people who talked and discussed so much. They, you know, clearly they think very differently.
Yes.
For example, Abu Hanifa tells Muhammad and Muslim that whatever I ask you, you answer from one of the accounts of Ahlul Bayt, of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, for example. One of the narrations. In any subject that I want to start to talk, you do not talk and you do not answer my questions unless you find it in the words of Ahlul Bayt. Don't you have your own thoughts and beliefs to talk about, to say? Muhammad al-Muslim, rahmatullah alayhi, says that no, this is the way Ahlul Bayt taught us. Do not talk in areas that we have not talked. So if I'm going to talk and deliver the message of God to someone, for example, in Ahkam al-Shari'a, in I'taqadat, for example, in beliefs. If I'm going to talk about them, because these affairs are so important, are so significant, I cannot implement my own understanding. I cannot prescribe it for other people, right? So we only depend on the narrations of Ahlul Bayt, what they have told us in terms of thought, in terms of action also, in our lives. In another narration also, to complete this debate, I would like to say that another companion of Imam Baqir alayhi salam once just wrote a letter to Imam Baqir and told him that there are a couple of, you know, some things happen for us that we do not have a hadith about them. Some questions happen, some affairs, you know, occur.
Events.
That we do not have a hadith. We don't know what to say. Can we say, depending on our own ideas, our own ways of thought, can we command? Can we kind of verdict there? Imam alayhi salam says, "La halaka man kana qablakum bidhan." Means do not say things that you do not believe to. Things that you just, you know, you think it's right.
Assume it's right.
You assume, yes.
You assume it's right.
Do not depend on your assumptions. Mm-hmm. No. If you do not have any hadith, you do not have a way of thinking from us, do not verdict. Do not talk about that area. And come ask us.
Thank you very much, Sheikhna. Brothers and sisters, we have to take a break. So please stay tuned to Heavenly Grief. We are talking about Imam Baqir alayhi salam, for these are the days of the anniversary of his martyrdom. So we would like to send our condolences to all the Shias around the world. So please tune back in. Thank you for joining us.
Imam Baqir, the fifth Shia leader and the son of Imam Sajjad, was born in Holy Medina in 57 after Hijra. Imam Baqir had a prominent lineage on both paternal and maternal ends, and his mother was Fatima, the daughter of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba. Imam Muhammad Baqir was named after his grandfather, the Holy Prophet of Islam, and due to his great scientific activities and achievements, he was titled Baqir al-Ulum, meaning the opener of knowledge. Imam Baqir was one of the survivors of Karbala tragedy as he was 4 years old in the time of the event. Along with his father and the rest of the pure household, Imam Baqir experienced the hard times of captivity in Kufa and Damascus. In this regard, the Holy Imam is quoted saying that the martyrdom of the 3-year-old daughter of Imam Hussein saved the lives of other captives, as the enemy had made up its mind to bury all captives under the rubble of the destructive building where they were settled. The Umayyad rulers were mostly preoccupied with fighting over power, and this gave enough space to Imam Baqir to begin a widespread scientific and religious movement, which revived the traditions of the Holy Prophet and educated many students. Contemporary to the life of Imam Baqir, the genuine Islamic thoughts were under attack by torrents of heretic thoughts, which were mostly originated from the forged narrations and the misinterpretations of Islamic teachings by the Umayyad underlings. Therefore, Imam Baqir focused his works on educating talented students and holding religious and scientific debates with non-Shia personalities. Determinism, the refutation of faith for minor sins, the belief that God has a body and can be seen, and the belief that sins have no consequences were only some of the widespread heretic thoughts at the time of Imam Baqir. Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari was the only companion of the Holy Prophet who lived long enough to meet Imam Muhammad Baqir. In fact, the Holy Prophet had informed Jabir that one day he will meet of the Prophet's descendants, who is called Imam Muhammad Baqir. Finally, this prophecy was realized, and Jabir met Imam Baqir and testified for his imamate. Despite the expansive works done to destroy the legacies of Imam Baqir, the narrations and teachings of the fifth Shia leader remain as one of the most sparkling beacons that shed light on the path of Shia Muslims in the fields of Islamic jurisprudence, interpretation of the Quran, and explanation of Islamic beliefs. Most of the acts of worship and the Islamic rituals we practice today are referenced to the juridical viewpoints of Imam Baqir, which have escaped the sight of enemies of Shia Islam in history. Finally, Imam Baqir was poisoned at the orders of the Umayyad rulers on 114 after Hijra, and he was buried in the cemetery of Baqi in Medina.
Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters. Thank you for tuning back in, and welcome to Heavenly Grief. With me today is Brother Sheikh Muhammad. We were talking about the life of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, as we stated, and as all you guys know, it's the anniversary of his martyrdom. And the brother was talking about the aspect of knowledge of the Imam reviving the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. We talked about a couple of points, and today we talked about the third and fourth points, actually.
Yes.
And the third point being
The emphasis of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Of writing down the sayings.
Yes, narrations.
And the fourth one being attributing knowledge to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam.
Yes, do not rely on your own understandings.
Yes. So I'm going to let you continue, Sheikh.
The next thing to talk about is to be aware of the different levels of the audiences that you have. Because as a person that wants to narrate a hadith to the people, wants to read something, for example, you are a teacher or a professor in the classroom, you're talking about Islamic thought and piety, and you want to talk to them, you want to educate them. A very important thing is to pay attention to the levels of your audience. Some people have high IQ, for example, they understand very quickly. Some people have been raised in families that have been not knowledgeable, very normal and ordinary families. You should talk to them in another way.
So each one's like a cup of water. Each one has its own volume. Someone could be like, for example, a tank. It could fill in a tank. Someone could be a small cup of tea.
Yes, very well said. So this was something that Imam Baqir salawatullah alayhi tried to teach the narrators very much. He tried to say that my followers, they consist of different levels and their understandings differ. So if you want to tell them a specific hadith, a specific narration, look at the person that you're talking to. Does he accept what you say or does he deny? Does that person have the capacity to understand, to hold it, and also to deliver to the next person narrated? Or does that person cannot hold these kind of narrations? So this regard of the audience is very important. For example, Imam Baqir Sallallahu Alaihi says, if you tell a person one of the virtues about us and he denies it, the sin of that denial is on your shoulders also. Why? Because you didn't check before talking to them, were they worthy of hearing that? You cannot just open your mouth and say whatever you want, even if you're talking about the virtues of Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. You cannot just blindly talk to people. You should know your audience. Mm-hmm. Is that person a first level, for example? Is that person somebody that has been trained for so many years? Does he accept? Which kind of virtue of Ahlul Bayt am I going to talk about? Different questions must be answered here. So this is one more important significant element that plays its role there. And the last thing that I would like to talk about is the aspect of being trustworthy and being very honest.
Mm. About reporting.
About that reporting and narrating job. Since it is very significant, it's essential, because the other next generations are going to use this, they're going to study this, they're going to learn their religion based on these. For example, ourselves. We learned our religion, the way of our life, from Quran and Hadith, Ahlul Bayt and Quran, the Book of God. So if the narrations are not trustable, then we cannot go to them, we cannot study them. And how to guarantee its trust, this is one of the ways. So to raise and educate some students that are trustworthy, very honest.
And this goes
about
back to
what they do.
As well as their behavior, their the way that they live. The Imam also follow man-managing them, you could say,
mm-hmm.
of their behavior, because, you know, being honest isn't a trait you only use in traditions or reporting narrations. Also, tradition throughout
everything.
Your daily life
yes.
matters.
Yes, everything. But this is more specifically emphasized because it has more significance
of
yes.
course, of the and the results of the same.
Yes, more consequences. And also, at last, some people came to Imam Baqir Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and told that we live in very faraway cities, faraway countries, and you are our Imam. We do not have access to you. We live in other cities, for example. And for these cases, Imam alayhi salam appointed some of the most trusted students, some of the students that the Imam were sure that they can achieve this task, appointed them and told other people to go to them.
To return to them.
Yes. If you have a question, you cannot find me, go to, for example, Aban ibn Taghlib or Muhammad ibn Muslim. Or
Zahar ibn
yes, Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, for example. These people were appointed by Imams alayhi salam. They are very knowledgeable, very trusted, very educated students of Imam alayhi salam. So people could find refuge. They could find answers for their questions and to purify the doubts they had, probably some confusions caused. And this helped the Shia so much in their lives.
Thank you very much, Sheikhna. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to accept your research. And hopefully to reward you with living in with Imam Baqir alayhi salam in the
Thank
heavens,
you so very much.
Ta'ala.
With you, inshallah.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached the end of this heavenly grief topic about Imam Baqir alayhi salam. And of course, it's the anniversary of his martyrdom. We would like to send our condolences to all the Shia around the world. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accept your grief and sorrow. We ask you as well, dear brothers and sisters, to not forget us from your prayers, especially in these days. From now until another heavenly grief, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv Stock Exchange Building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital Abu Dhabi and a consulate in the UAE's business hub Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel. But former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba, beginning with the Bay of Pigs. They launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and Financial Blockade Imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.N. U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade.
Including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and the surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spymaster and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
when it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassins squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest the people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain Al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including Al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khawr group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the U.S. that often claim to be anti-terrorism rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interests to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West's support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The former Bank of England Governor Mark Carney believes that harnessing capitalism and the power of money will bring about the changes needed in time to avoid climate breakdown. We now present you an article written by environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled "Former Bank of England Governor Urges Regulate Business to Tackle Climate Crisis." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former Bank of England Governor Mark Carney has urged governments must step up their regulation of businesses to tackle the climate crisis because the financial free markets will not reduce greenhouse gas emissions alone. Mark Carney, who left the Bank of England last year before the first COVID-19 lockdown, is now one of the so-called influential figures working on COP26, the vital United Nations climate talks to be held in Glasgow this November. He's a United Nations envoy on climate change and UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson's finance advisor on the climate. He said for the world to meet its climate goals, governments would have to force industries to follow clear rules on everything from energy generation to construction and transport, and set carbon prices that would drive investment towards green ends and close down fossil fuels. He said, "We need clear, credible and predictable regulation from government," adding, "air quality rules, building codes, the type of strong regulation is needed. You can have strong regulation for the future, then the financial market will start investing today for that future, because that's what markets do, they always look forward." He said without such robust intervention from governments, markets would fail to address the crisis. Mark Carney noted, "It wouldn't happen spontaneously by the financial sector, but we can't get there without the financial sector." Mark Carney said people must also press political leaders to act. He said, "When people have made it clear they have the objective of tackling the climate crisis, and if there is public policy that translates those wishes into real action, a price on carbon, regulation of internal combustion engines, for example, then financial markets, capitalism, will come up with the solutions to give people what they want." The former Bank of England governor pointed to Boris Johnson's promise to purportedly ban sales of new diesel and petrol-driven cars from 2030. Car manufacturers are responding. Nissan has announced a £1 billion electric car hub in Sunderland, while Vauxhall's owner, Stellantis, is making a £100 million investment in Ellesmere Port. Mark Carney said, "We've seen the automotive industry saying, wait a minute, we have to make big investments in order to supply people with cars of the future." However, Mark Carney still sees a future for fossil fuels. In May, the International Energy Agency, the IEA, said if the world was to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius of global heating, there could be no more exploration or development of fossil fuel resources. Markani argues, however, that countries and companies could still carry on exploiting fossil fuels despite this advice, if they use technology such as carbon capture and storage or other ways of reducing emissions. He said, "You have to take it on the specific projects. If fossil fuel producers are able, though through considerable investment in carbon capture and storage, to get to net zero emission, then that creates some room in the carbon budget." In Canada, for instance, where Markani is from and partly lives, and where, according to rumors, he's reported to be considering a political career, he said oil sands producers could continue to develop their high carbon resources if they reduce their emissions and Canada can make changes elsewhere. Markani claimed Canada has an objective of 40 to 45% down on greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. He added, "I'm not going to dictate exactly how that is accomplished, but the critical thing is the aggregate." Former Governor of the Bank of England, Markani, insisted companies should also be able to use carbon offsets to meet climate targets. The practice of offsetting, funding, the planting of trees or protection of forests or other projects and reduce carbon to make up for a company's or individual's emissions has become increasingly controversial. Some fraudulent schemes have been uncovered in which carbon credits did not exist or did not represent an actual reduction in emissions. Other schemes have been found to fail to protect forests, allowing logging to continue while selling carbon credits based on keeping forests standing. Markani has drawn criticism from environmental groups over his support for offsetting, but remains a staunch advocate. He said, "I'm of the view that offsets can play a role because they extend the carbon budget." He added, "It's a bit like when we think about people living on a very tight budget. If you can find ways to save a bit of money here and there or earn a bit more money, you do it. That's what this is." Part of the purpose of carbon credits is to protect areas of forests under threat, such as the Amazon rainforest or in Southeast Asia, with the additional benefits of preserving natural ecosystems and helping indigenous peoples. He said the world has not yet found other ways of keeping rainforests protected, adding, "We may not like it that it makes sense to have private companies pay to stop the burning, but it makes a lot more sense to do that and preserve the rainforest than to just let it happen. Unfortunately, we've been just letting it happen." Despite criticism of companies greenwashing before COP26 summit, and despite his acknowledgement that we have left it very late to begin seriously cutting down greenhouse gas emissions, Markani believes that harnessing capitalism and the power of money will bring about the changes needed in time to avoid climate breakdown. He said, "With the right regulation, with a rising carbon price, with a financial sector that is oriented this way, with public accountability of government, of financial institutions, of companies, yes, then we can. We certainly have the conditions in which to achieve holding global heating down to 1.5 degrees Celsius, claiming that's our objective."
ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. We've been speaking about the necessity of prophethood. Today we're going to speak about this a little more. We said that in order for a human being to achieve felicity in this world and in the hereafter, he has to have a certain type of knowledge, a knowledge about his creator, about who he is, where he is, where he's going, and what is the end of his existence, what is the goal of his existence. All of these things are required for this knowledge of these things are required for a man to be felicitous and to be happy, to be fulfilled in this world. And we said that this is not something that a man can arrive at on his own. Rather, he needs the assistance of the divine revelation. We said that it's possible for somebody to raise the following objection here, and say this, that we see that there have been certain thinkers throughout the history of human thought who have arrived at the same conclusions as the divine revelation speaks about. They also believed in God. They believed in his oneness. They believed in his infinite power. They believed in the eternity of the human soul, that God will recompense human beings for their actions in this world, in another world, that he will punish those people who were evil in this world, and so on and so forth. All of these conclusions, all of these things that the divine revelation speaks about, there have been thinkers who have arrived at the same conclusion using their minds, using their powers of reason, without the assistance of divine revelation. What is the need for divine revelation? And why is it that we are required, God is required to teach us about these things through revelation? He doesn't need to tell us about it. He's given us the faculty of reasoning, and we can use it to arrive at these conclusions. We've been examining this question and answering it from different points of view. One of the ways that we can discuss this is from this point of view, and looking at the limitations of the powers of reasoning, and say this, that reasoning only has the ability to understand certain general and universal principles. Without the assistance of some other faculty, regardless of whether that faculty is within man or outside of man, it can't understand certain details about the conclusions it has arrived at on its own. For example, if you look outside, without looking outside, your mind can't tell you whether it's night or day. Right? In a similar manner, there has to be a particular faculty which has particular knowledge about the other world, right, after this world, which can tell us what are the conclusions and results and effects of the actions we perform in this world and in the next world. For example, we know that if we perform an evil action, it's going to have an effect in the hereafter. But what that is, we don't know. For example, Revelation tells us that when somebody lies in the hereafter, he's going to be fed fire, or when somebody usurps the wealth of an orphan, in the other world it manifests itself in the form of fire, a person eating fire and fire entering his stomach. Now, this is something that the power of reason cannot arrive at without the assistance of a particular faculty, and this is not something at the same time, it's not something that the senses can assist him in. So there has to be another means of knowledge, and that is the divine revelation. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the problem of the divine revelation. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome
and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.